From the heartland of America and the gateway to the West, good morning, good evening, wherever you may be across the nation, around the world. I'm George Norrie. Welcome to Coast AM. Later on tonight, it's called Plain Dead. What a strange story, but we'll have it. Here's what's happening. A Georgia father convicted of murder after leaving his toddler son in a hot car two summers ago has been sentenced to life in prison without the possibility of parole. Now, on the face of it, you may think, my gosh, that's pretty harsh for being stupid and foolish. Life in prison. But it's a bigger story. Jurors last month convicted Justin Ross Harris of malice murder and other charges in that 2014 death of his 22-month-old son, Cooper, who was left in the car for 7 hours in sweltering heat. But here's the big part of the story. The jurors believe that Harris left the little boy to die on purpose, and that's why he got life in prison. The man who owned the converted Oakland warehouse known as the Ghost Ship, which caught fire over the weekend, killing 36 people, drew scrutiny over a Facebook post in which he lamented over what he had lost. Derek Ion's Facebook post received more than 2,000 mostly critical comments before it was deleted. This is what it said. Confirmed, everything I worked so hard for is gone. Blessed that my children and Micah were at a hotel safe and sound. It is as if I have awoken from a dream filled with opulence and hope to be standing now in the poverty of self-worth. 36 people died. And he apparently posted that. After initially recalling 17,000 pounds of chicken, Oklahoma-based National Steak and Poultry has expanded its announcement to include an additional nearly 2 million pounds of ready-to-eat chicken that may be undercooked. Let's check in with our food safety coach, Jeff Nelkin. Jeff, 2 million pounds of chicken? How could this happen?
I don't know. It's definitely a breach in quality control, that's for sure. But, you know, I just want to remind, you know, the listeners that when you're dealing with raw chicken, for example, in your house, traditionally people have always washed the chicken. The latest findings are that washing the chicken is a big mistake because we tend to splash a lot of the juices around the kitchen and have potential for additional contamination. So do not wash the chicken. When you cook the chicken and you cook it to 165 degrees, you will kill the salmonella and make that chicken safe to eat.
Now, in this particular case, undercooked chicken, obviously some problem with the stove or whatever they use to cook this stuff.
Right. The processing system malfunctioned, and they did not keep records of, you know, the product, you know, ever reaching the 165. And it seemed to have been picked up by some of the consumers noticing that the chicken meat was on the pinkish side.
All right, Jeff, thank you so much. Jeff Nelkin's website, of course, foodsafetycoach.com. A handful of nuts each day could be key to fighting a range of diseases, killer diseases, according to scientists. They say just a 1 ounce portion is enough to slash the risk of heart disease, cancer, obesity. Analysis suggests that even a small daily serving cuts the risk of coronary heart disease by 30%, cancer by 15%, premature death by 22%. It can also halve the risk of respiratory disease, cut it right in half, and reduces diabetes by nearly 40%. How ironic, because years ago, the late American prophet Edgar Cayce talked about eating nuts. He said, eat 3 almonds a day to prevent cancer. And as a matter of fact, I also eat bitter apricot seeds as well. Makes a great difference. A federal judge has ordered a recount of Michigan's presidential ballots and for the state to assemble necessary staff to work sufficient hours to complete the recount by a December 13th federal deadline there. The United Kingdom has bought the capsule which its astronaut, Tim Peake, was shot into space and returned him to Earth. They are going to put it on display. It is a Russian Soyuz spacecraft. What else is going on in the skies? Let's check in with Dr. Sky, Stephen Cates. Hey, Stephen.
Hello, George. So many wonderful things. Welcome to December. And again, happy holidays. Merry Christmas to the listeners. But, George, this is really cool. We've been hearing over the weekend that the Cassini spacecraft, indeed, been out there around the area of Saturn and orbiting Saturn for quite some time, made an interesting passage near and through this ring system that's so spectacular. And many may not know, this particular spacecraft is powered by nuclear power. And sadly, in the year 2017, it will all be extinct, meaning the spacecraft will probably be plunged into the cloud tops of Saturn. But we learned so much. But closer to home, George, as we get to hopefully in just a moment, the live sky, we find out here that a company called Moon Express, many listeners may have heard about this, it's the first company, the first private company granted permission by the FAA to actually conduct these manned missions to the moon. And by maybe 2026, the price tag has been put very low, considering $10,000 to make this mission to the moon. It all sounds like the stuff of dreams, but you bet we can dream here on this program, and we do all the time. But in the live sky, here's some cool things that are happening. The planet Mercury can be seen low into the southwest for most of the listening audience. This week it's at its peak, called its greatest elongation. And then Monday evening, pay attention, folks, to the moon. George, it'll be spectacular, coming to another of the supermoons on the 14th. But on the night of the 12th, Monday night, for West Coast listeners, just around 7 p.m., look at the left edge of the moon, the brilliant star Aldebaran. It will make another of these great occultations. You'll see the star in a pair of binoculars literally dance along the mountains of the moon and then magically disappear, only to pop out the other side in about 45 minutes or so. That supermoon on the 14th, this is called a long night full moon, of course, because of the solstice, and the Geminid meteor shower, though it will be hampered by the light of the moon. George, this is a great one because we see lots of bright fireballs look to the direction of the full moon and areas to the left and right. Dr. Sky always reminds everyone, always remember to keep your eyes to the skies.
Thank you, Stephen. We'll be talking a lot about those Geminids, to be sure. In a moment, we're going to talk about Undeniable, how biology confirms our intuition that life is designed. A great story. Douglas Axe with us next on Coast to Coast AM. Okay, welcome back to Coast to Coast. George Norrie with you. Engineer turned molecular biologist Douglas Axe is director of the Biologic Institute. That's in Seattle. Now, this research uses experiments and computer simulations to examine the functional and structural constraints on the evolution of proteins and protein systems. We'll find out about that. After earning a Caltech PhD, he has a postdoctoral and research scientist positions at the University of Cambridge and the Cambridge Medical Research Council Center as well. His work and ideas have been featured in many scientific journals. His book, Undeniable, How Biology Confirms Our Intuition That Life is Designed. Douglas, we're going to have fun talking about this one. Welcome to the show.
Ah, thank you for having me.
What, by the way, tell me about this work of evolution of proteins and protein systems. What are they?
What are the proteins that
we're
talking about?
What is all that?
These are sometimes single molecules. So proteins are chains of amino acids that fold into specific structures within cells, and they do the hard work that it takes for a cell to live as a cell. So the chemistry, metabolism is chemistry that is carried out by enzymes within cells. Each of these enzymes is a protein. Sometimes there are multiple protein molecules that stick together. There are molecular motors that are made of proteins. So really, all the action that's happening at the subcellular level for every kind of life to work is orchestrated by these proteins. Each protein is encoded by a gene. So the sequence of a gene in DNA is what tells these cells how to arrange these amino acids in sequence to make a protein.
Science is just wonderful, isn't it, Douglas?
It is. And now, it can be complicated.
Tell me how you got involved in all this science. A little kid, were you interested in this when you were a boy?
I was very interested in science, but not so interested in biology, actually. I was more of a physical science kid, and that's maybe why I studied engineering and not biology as an undergraduate. It wasn't until I entered graduate school that I started to connect biology to engineering and became really fascinated with the thought that these things, these protein systems that I was looking at or was being taught about in my graduate course on molecular genetics and biochemistry, that these things might actually be engineered and that it might be possible to demonstrate that.
It's amazing what has been going on in the world of science these days. Now, you would consider yourself a scientist, would you not?
Correct.
A scientist who believes in the possibility of intelligent design, which is unique.
It's not absolutely unique, but it's definitely rare.
It is. So undeniable. Tell us about the title.
Okay. Well, one of my daughters actually came up with the title. I had a number of other work titles before we got to Undeniable, and she said, how about Undeniable? And I Googled it, as you do, when someone suggests a title, and I found that Bill Nye has a book called Undeniable that's preaching Darwinism, and I thought, well, maybe in light of that, I should come up with a different title. But I ran it past several friends, and they said, no, why don't you go ahead and use it and invite the comparison.
And the good thing about books is you can have 16 books with the same title and still do that. I think we lost him, Tom, so give him a call, if you would. We'll get him back on. Let's get him back on, and he just disappeared all of a sudden. Poof, wherever he may have gone. We're talking about his book called Undeniable, How Biology Confirms Our Intuition, and Douglas Axe, of course, has been a professor and a researcher at Cambridge University, and he is going to be talking about intelligent design and how that works. So we will get him as soon as we can. I hope so. If not, it'll be one of those nights where we do open lines again. This is going to be one of those strange nights. It seems like every time we're in the process of getting somebody controversial on, they simply disappear and that they are simply gone. So let's be on the safe side. Let me give you some of the phone numbers just in case. And you know what? I'll do open lines, folks, if we have to. So let me give you the numbers. West of the Rockies, 800-618-8255. East of the Rockies, 800-825-5033. First-time caller line, 818-501-4721. Oh, Tommy tells me we finally have him, so punch him up. Douglas, you're back with us. Where'd you go?
I have no idea. What was I saying when I left?
We were talking about how your daughter gave you the title for Undeniable, okay. And then poof, you were gone.
I don't know what happened. But we've been having problems with this phone, so we'll be going with cell phone from now on.
All right, let's do that. And just make sure it's plugged in so it doesn't run out of battery life, and we'll just plot along this way. But okay. So anyways, the title, Undeniable, let's get into that.
By that I'm referring to, did you hear me talk about the design intuition, what I mean
know.
By it?
No, we didn't get to that.
Okay. So this has been acknowledged, broadly acknowledged by professors in psychology, who studied children and how they think about life, that by the age of 3 or 4, all of us, regardless of our background, we don't have to come from a religious background, we can even come from an atheistic background, we all, when we look at living things, attribute them to a godlike designer. And of course, as we grow older, we enter high school, college, we're told that that intuition is false and that we need to override it with the Darwinian explanation of life, and many of us do override it in that way, but all of us throughout life find ourselves having to suppress this intuition. Either we accept it or we suppress it, but it keeps popping its head up. And I argue in the book, not only is the intuition universal, but it's actually correct. And our simple experiences that confirm it are scientific in nature. You can also do technical science and show that the intuition is correct, but the book argues using first simple science before talking about technical science. So that's what I claim is undeniable, ultimately, is this intuition. You can try to suppress it and replace it with something else, but it never goes away, and it's ultimately undeniable.
And Douglas, when we talk about design, probably one of the most perplexing questions that mankind can face, and that is, of course, who are we? How do we get here? What is God? And, you know, we have the two camps that there's a process of just evolution, and that's how life evolved, and here we are. And then we've got the intelligent design possibilities. And I think there's a possibility of both of them being included. But still the big question remains is how in the world, or how in the universe, did this even start? That's what's so mind-boggling to me. Elon Musk thinks we're in a computerized matrix, that we're really not even here. What do you think of that?
That sounds nutty to me. I think, but if you're talking about the origin of life, that is a huge question. And if you look at what's needed for life to work, at least life as we know it, it turns out to be just remarkably orchestrated, sophisticated molecular mechanisms are needed. Proteins in large number, these are the things that I've studied. And when you look at what's needed for a protein to work, it turns out to involve a whole lot of information. So a whole lot of information, which is really equivalent to knowledge, is needed for life, even in its simplest form, to exist. That doesn't come from nowhere. It doesn't come from accidental causes.
When a scientist goes out of the norm, you said it yourself, that it's rare to believe in intelligent design, do they come under fire from their administration or whomever?
You know, I may not be, I don't know that it's rare. What I know is that it's rare for someone to be outspokenly in favor of intelligence.
Well, I think it's rare. I mean, I've interviewed a lot of scientists, and most of them don't believe in intelligent design.
But on your show?
On the show.
Well, that would be outspoken. What I'm saying is, when you speak to people behind closed doors, not to be released to the public, You sometimes get a different story than you get when the microphone is on. What is true, definitely, is that life scientists who come out in favor of intelligent design can expect to pay a price for that. Science, as you know, professional scientists depend on peer review for a number of things that are just crucial to their careers. For publishing papers, for getting grant money, for getting promotion, tenure, all of these things are peer-based decisions. So your peers are evaluating you and checking you off on these various crucial aspects of your career. If you aggravate your peers in some way, you can expect there to be trouble at each one of those points, all of which are crucial for your career. So the wise person who cares about his or her career in the sciences, in the life sciences, is going to be quiet about things that cause aggravation for his or her peers. I think that's the reality of it.
Almost like a pilot who might see something very strange out there and doesn't report it.
Exactly. There are things that you would do better to be quiet about if you care about how smoothly things go for you in your job.
You have a passion, and I'm fascinated with that because you're very blunt about this, that you're very passionate about the fact that we do have this childlike intuition that we've had all our lives, that we believe that there is a designer, and you stand pat with that. I'm impressed with that.
Very much so, yeah.
What got you to that? Or did you always have it?
The notion that there is a designer. I think, if I think back, I'm a person of faith. I'm a Christian since my teen years. But before that, I was not, and was not, my family was not a church-going family. As I think back, and it's not that easy to do, because I didn't keep a journal, so I don't know exactly how I thought about things when I was, say, 13, 14 years old. I don't think I ever found the Darwinian story to be plausible. But I, to be honest, didn't give it a lot of thought until I started looking at biology carefully. And by that point, not only did I not find it to be plausible, but I had an alternative explanation. For me, the designer is God, and it was not a problem for me to say, well, clearly, these are things that were done by God. That fits with the design intuition.
Was saying... Go ahead.
Had I not had faith at that point, I'm not sure how. I definitely would have been skeptical of Darwinism, and I think I would have been scratching my head and saying, "This sure looks like something that God would have done."
So when we come back, let's talk about God and what you think God might be, and how that fits into the equation of Life. Undeniable is the name of the book. Douglas Axe is with us. We got him back, and we'll be back in a moment on Coast to Coast AM. Okay, welcome back to Coast, Douglas Axe with us. We're going to take calls with Douglas next hour. We're talking about his work called Undeniable. It's an amazing book about how biology confirms our intuition that life is designed. Douglas, I'm going to ask you that question, of course, that I ask everybody. Do you believe in God? And of course you do. But what is God as far as you're concerned?
Well, I would say, who is God? And I would say if you take this intuition, this design intuition seriously, it tells you that there is a creator, there is someone who made the things that we see, the living things, including us. And it tells you something about that designer, that God, but it doesn't reveal much beyond the fact that this designer is brilliant and has a sense of humor and is artistic. To get beyond that, you have to ask, well, if this God is real and if we were made by this God, would this God not have made us for a reason? Would there not be a purpose for us being here? And if so, would he not have revealed that purpose to us? And from there, you have to go to Scripture. You can't get from science anything beyond the basics. But I think the basics point people to something more specific. If we were made, then it stands to reason that we were made for a purpose, and we should know that purpose. And if you made something for a purpose, you would reveal the purpose. You'd write the purpose down. So that's how I think about it.
And how was the designer created?
Well,
you answer that. So, $64,000 on its way to your house.
Well, I can't answer. The designer was not created. The designer is eternal. But I get that not from a scientific experiment, not from an experiment on proteins, but as I said, once you take this idea seriously, and I think you have to if you think seriously about origins, then you ask, is there specific revelation? Has God revealed himself to humankind through Scripture, through spoken word, through written word? And I take the Bible to be that, and the Bible reveals that God is eternal. So that answers that question for me.
What do you find to be controversial about all of this, Douglas?
I don't think there's anything that should be controversial. But I can understand that things are controversial. This idea, to life scientists, looks like it's a throwing out of 150 years of biology post-Darwin, because it is. And many people in that situation get scared about what does that mean for biology and where would biology go if people took this seriously. I don't want to turn biology back to something old. In fact, in my book, the last chapter of my book is called The New School. I think we have not even scratched the surface in biology, and I think once we throw off this old idea of materialism, naturalism, and take design seriously, we are on the verge of making the most profound connection between engineering and biology that has ever been made, far beyond anything that has been made. So I'm looking forward to something new in the life sciences. I don't think we should be afraid of embracing design, but I understand that people think differently, and for many of them it is a scary thought.
Why do so many religions, Douglas, tie in this creationism under religious aspects as opposed to more scientific?
Well, if it is a fact that we were created, then it makes sense to me that throughout all cultures, and I believe this is true, throughout all cultures, throughout all time, there are creation stories. And I think if you were an atheist, you could say, well, humans have to come up with stories to justify certain things, to justify a legal structure,
right,
or justify some sort of moral structure, and therefore they always have some sort of creation story. An alternative explanation would be that we really were created, and so tracing all the way back, we really do have stories, and those stories get changed, as stories do with time. But we all have the story, because we all have to account for why we're here.
If we were not created, via intelligent design, if we were not created by that, how were we made? What happened? What fluke of nature? What accidents were in place? And then again, we keep coming back to, well, no, there had to be a design for all this to happen. But I mean, assuming we did not have anything creative design us, how did it happen, in your opinion?
Well, I think I would agree that the Darwinian story is the most plausible alternative. The question is whether it is plausible or not. And I think it's very interesting. There's a book that I, or actually an author of a book that I interact with in my book. His book is called Mind and Cosmos. Subtitle is Why the Materialist Neo-Darwinian Conception of Nature is Almost Certainly False. The author is a philosopher of mind and a very well-known, renowned philosopher of mind named Thomas Nagel. He's an atheist, and as an atheist, he has recognized that the materialist framework, the materialist neo-Darwinian framework, cannot account for mind. It cannot account for consciousness. It cannot account for cognition, our higher rational faculties, and it cannot account for moral sense, all of which he concedes are true, are real things at the very center of reality. So he says, if your conception of reality cannot account for these things, then you've got a bankrupt conception of reality. We have to go back to the drawing board and rethink nature. And he's saying this as an atheist. I find it very interesting that some of the most honest thinkers on this recognize that you cannot get from atoms and molecules to consciousness and moral sense.
I'm assuming that under the chicken and egg theory, that what happened under Darwinism is that this creature that was similar to a chicken kept evolving and kept evolving and kept evolving. And then out of an egg, out of whatever creatures they were, out of an egg popped the chicken under its evolution. And then that chicken started laying eggs of other chickens, and there they are. Do you think that's how that happened?
Well, the evolutionary story would be that the chicken, like us and everything else, came from something simpler that predated it. And so the Darwinian account would say that the most recent common ancestor of human beings and chickens was something that had all the features that both chickens and humans have, but didn't have the more specialized features that make a chicken distinctly chicken or a human distinctly human. So among the things that we and chickens both have are skin and bones and a heart and circulatory system and a brain. So the Darwinist would say those things were all resident in this earlier creature, whatever it looked like. It wouldn't have looked very much like a chicken or very much like a human, because all the other things that have those features had to have come from this, and so on. And you can keep tracing that back. A worm doesn't have a backbone. A bacterial cell doesn't even have a body. It only has one cell. So it's that same sort of line of reasoning, that all the things that are shared in groups of living organisms came from some original form, which came from an earlier form, which came from an earlier form, ultimately all the way back to the first life form, which would have been a simple bacterium.
Douglas Axe with us. His book is called Undeniable. His websites are linked up at coasttocoastam.com for you. Douglas, under this aspect of intelligent design, do you have to be spiritual in order to accept that theory?
No, you don't. And in fact, Thomas Nagel, I just mentioned, is an atheist who doesn't come out and say he accepts the theory, but he gives strong endorsement of the importance of the thinking of intelligent design. In other words, he criticizes people for being unfair in their critique of intelligent design, and he says these arguments have to be taken seriously. There are other people who favor intelligent design and don't know what to make of the designer, and I think probably David Berlinski would be among those, and he might call himself an agnostic. I don't know what he calls himself, but he's not religious.
In the book Undeniable, what would you say might be the most important aspect of the book?
Well, it's there are several things that I think are important. One is making a simple argument that everyone can get. You don't have to have a PhD. You don't have to be a scientist to understand that this intuition is ultimately correct. It's not correct because it's an intuition. It's correct because science backs it up, even the simple kind of signs of experience, everyday experience that we all have. So that's important, nugget one. One of the other important things, if I say three of them, I would say number two,
okay,
is that this has implications for how we do science. I referred to the new school as being the final chapter of the book, chapter 14. Once we take the fact that that design is real and it is a true explanation of life, I think it allows us to go back to the most fundamental questions in biology, the most fundamental of which is, what is life? And it allows us to rethink that from an entirely different perspective. I make a connection in chapter 14 of the book between engineering disciplines like computer science and what biology should be if we were allowed to think of biology in terms of concepts and ideas that are implemented in living forms. And as a Darwinist, you can't think of it that way. You have to think of living forms as being accidental outcomes of the Darwinian process. An entirely accidental chance process produces these things, not some ideas or principles that were instantiated in these things. The third thing that's important, I think, is a realistic view of the frailty of the scientific endeavor. That I think, and this is changing, but I think in the West we have thought for many generations of science as being something that's self-correcting, that the scientific method guarantees that science is always on the right track, or if it's off track, it will correct itself, and it is always on a course toward more and more accurate description of the truth. The reality is, and I try to gently explain this through my own experience, that science is a very human endeavor. It is as human as every other endeavor. And so all of the factors that come into play that complicate business and politics and every other human sphere, they're there complicating science as well. And I think I say that not to reduce anyone's opinion of science, but to give people a realistic notion of what science really is, and it really can get stuck on wrong ideas for reasons that have nothing to do with data and everything to do with the way humans operate when you put them in a culture.
Douglas, creatures on this planet, outside of human beings, all have similarities in that they exist, they eat, they procreate, and their day-to-day existence is survival. The humankind, however, goes beyond that. It goes beyond procreating and eating and just survival. It becomes a thinking machine. It becomes something that builds things, that worries, that gets depressed, that, you know, is concerned about financial things and stuff. That gap between these creatures on this planet that just want to get by every day, they want to survive, they have that will to live, and then us is enormous. What created that gap?
Well, it is, it's astounding, actually, because we all know that we are compared to chimpanzees, and when the Human Genome Project came out, and then the chimpanzee genome was published, there's all these attempts to say that we are so similar to our close cousin, the chimpanzee. But in a more obvious sense, a chimpanzee is not that unlike a mouse in that they do the same basic things. They are eating and procreating and fighting and surviving. And they're not doing the higher things that we do. So in that sense, really the chimp is akin to a mouse and akin to these other creatures that all are getting by, and they do some things in a more clever way, but they're still just spending their time getting by, whereas we turn our attention toward art and mathematics and conversation and literature and entertainment and comedy and all these things, this whole higher realm that doesn't even exist for these other creatures.
No, it doesn't.
It does seem remarkable to me. Well, you'll notice that I think everyone sees this as being a problem, and I think that's why there's such a concerted effort to reassure us that, no, actually, we are apes, and there's a concerted effort among Darwinists to say we should not think of ourselves as being special. We are not a special species. We're just one of millions, and we need to think of ourselves as being just one more of this collection, where it seems so obvious that we're not.
We're not. I can't see that at all. We are different. We are special. We are one incredible thinking machine. And, you know, to compare us, look, I love dogs and I love cats and animals. But they have their own finite existence every day. And even though they interact with us, of course,
right,
we've gone way beyond that, and there's something within us that does that, and I think it was put there. I think it was designed to be there.
Yeah, I believe that's true.
When someone stands up for that and, you know, truly becomes vocal about intelligent design, which to me is God, I think they ought to be applauded, but in many cases they're not, are they?
They're not. I mean, you will be applauded in some circles and you'll be vilified in others. So in my experience, I tell the story of losing my job in 2002 in Cambridge, and it was over the controversy. It wasn't over someone being upset that I believed in God, but it was over worry that the whole controversy over intelligent design would boil over and cause the center where I was to fall into disrepute. So
wow.
There's this reaction that's regrettable, but it's a very human thing, that even people who aren't particularly upset about or in strong disagreement with intelligent design can be worried for their own career or their own center, their own reputation.
They get blacklisted.
They want to distance themselves from everything that looks disreputable.
And schools, too. They don't have the guts to teach what you have in this book, Undeniable, do they?
Well, if you mean like high schools or public schools, I think there's this huge political constraint that's more complicated actually here in America.
Yeah, they're petrified by Britain. See, they you know, the old amendment of church and state, they're petrified that if you talk about intelligent design, you're teaching religion. That's the farthest from the case.
Correct. I think there's more freedom than most teachers think, but no one wants to be the example that's trotted out and becomes, you know, part of the trial of the century or something.
If you were trying to convince someone who doesn't believe in intelligent design, how would you start?
Well, I would start the way I did in the book, which is just pointing to this intuition that we all have. And I would argue with the person that you, if you're honest with yourself, you know that this intuition proves true. It's not false. And so that's what I try to do in the book. For the first chunk of the book, I'm leveraging the fact that we all have this sense to argue to the reader who might be skeptical at first that if you're honest about how you evaluate this, you'll see that this sense is correct, that actually the observations we have show that this is true, that certain things, I call them inventions, can't happen by accident, that there's too many things that have to be orchestrated in order for something as simple as a text message to be composed, that it will never happen by accident. And if that's true of a text message, then it's surely true of a human being or a cat or a dog.
Let's come back in our final hour with you, Douglas, and take some phone calls as we talk about Undeniable. We'll open them up right now.